Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. I'm Joe Devine and I'm now joined by JJ Bull the Bullard. Hello, JJ.
Hello, Joe Devine. It was New Year, a new time for shenanigans.
Yes, indeed it was. Happy New Year to all the TIFOs out there listening, the TIPOs. Of course, also joined, guten Tag, Herr Stafford Bloor. Wie geht's to?
Mir geht es gut, Herr Devine. How are you?
Yes, I'm fine. A new year is here, and I'm a new me. We'll be talking today about the several games of football that happened over the festive period. Yes, Chelsea-Liverpool, big game from the Sunday. Arsenal-Manchester City, that was an exciting one on the Saturday. Of course, there's a little bit of Watford-Spurs too. We're going to look ahead to AFCON, something exciting we'll be covering within the month of January. Perhaps a little bit of transfer talk as well. And hey, Everton-Brighton, big result there too. But for now, if you like to go big or go home, you can do both with The Athletic. Visit theathletic.com/TIFO, where you'll get all the best footballing stories. Visit theathletic.com/TIFO for honestly unrivaled coverage. Go big whilst going home. Now, I'll leave you in the warm hands and the sweet, cool embrace of a new year. Chelsea 2-2 Liverpool. Now, this game, of course, Seb, most of the pre-match conversation was set in the backdrop of Lukaku's absence, a decision made by Thomas Tuchel. I should stress we're recording this on the Monday. It won't be released until the Tuesday. It's possible the story will have updated by then, so we won't spend a long time talking about it. We might come back to discuss that a little bit. I suppose the first thing to say about this game, though, was that it was great. It was a great game. Or at least it was a really, really great first half of a game.
Yeah, and as a measure of that, about half an hour before kickoff, you texted me to say, will you talk to me during the game so that I can pay attention and sure, I can remain engaged? But you didn't really need that in the end.
No, I didn't.
You managed to stay engaged all by yourself. And it was, it's like a sort of a hangover of a football match where all the structure has been sort of dissipated, the players are exhausted, and chaos kind of reigns. And it was all the better for it. But within that... because sometimes within that kind of situation, you can get kind of sloppy football. And we did have mistakes, but there were also amazing moments of expression and skill and things that you don't usually see from players. Like there was a N'Golo Kante through ball where he cut the pass through to between the fullback and the centre-back to Marcus Alonso early in the second half, which I know we know that Kante is a, you know, is a, an accomplished attacking player as well as all the defensive stuff he does. But you don't see kind of that level of expression from him. And the Kovacic volley, which I don't think I've seen before anywhere.
No.
Actually. Apart from like maybe in the park, like when you're, you know, you're off balance, the ball's kind of falling towards you. You don't really want to run back and readjust. So you just think, I will just hit it and see what happens.
Well, this
and
is the thing I was going to ask JJ about this, because the Kovacic goal, of course, from outside of the box, a volley from a ball coming down from the high heavens, JJ. It wasn't normally when you see a goal scored of that, a sort of quality and caliber of the arc and the pace that the ball travels at. You see a player who sort of mirrors that, but what Kovacic seemed to do was sort of jump with both legs at once and then lean backwards and do a kind of half scissor kick for this to go into the perfect spot in the goal. I'm not sure I've ever seen technique like that before. Have you?
I can't think if I have seen it. I think he's just adjusting on the fly. I mean, it looks like his leg is completely straight. It's like in, there's an episode of Seinfeld where Kramer has to wear trousers that are too tight for him and he has to walk like Frankenstein's monster around. And it's a bit like that. So he has to use a full, the whole leg goes, yes. You know, for the As though it's one part.
As long as
not
he doesn't have a knee.
Components.
Yeah. It has no knee.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. That's exactly what I was trying
He's
to
knee-less.
Say. That's like a pendulum.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's lovely.
It's all instinct, it's just, right?
Yeah, it's instinct. It's also great core strength, I think. This is one of the things. It's to do with like the balance he has to stand on that one leg to do that. Like a lot of things you'll do in yoga or anything that involves your core is going to be standing on one leg. And he's able to do that, but contain... Like, the way he hits it is perfect. It's just it's perfectly weighted, the way he puts it in the net. The poor goalie, he was playing so well as well. Nothing you can do about that whatsoever.
Sure, sure. There we go. Well, of course, you mentioned Kovacic and Kante there, Seb. One of the impressive things, JJ, about Chelsea in this game was their midfield. It was a two versus effectively Liverpool's three, but they appear to sort of outrun them at all times. And was this just a feature of the players in question? Of course, Henderson and Milner were featuring in Liverpool's midfield, or was there something tactically happening here?
I mean, both managers know how the other one's going to play. There was a change that Tuchel made later on, which he corrected as well. I can't remember who took off, but he changed with three in midfield and two up top.
Yeah.
And that small change meant that he didn't have a player either side of the centre forward tracking Liverpool's wing backs, and they are wing backs really, which meant they had all the width in the side of the pitch. But he corrected that by putting Hudson-Odoi on and trying to change the way they were defending late in the game. But early on, the two, Kante and Kovacic are really busy players. Liverpool, it's not that we're overrun, they just kept making little errors. I thought it was just little mistakes, they were getting caught in possession quite early. And Chelsea, both teams were pressing really high, very aggressively. They both are playing a really crazily high line. I loved it, because that's where you get those mistakes from. It makes it more entertaining. It's more like a video game from the early 2000s, where it's just end-to-end. And I think like Henderson was having to clear it a little bit. He's not quite as composed as maybe like Milner or Fabinho. Fabinho's making some weird mistakes, getting the ball received when he's not looking maybe just quickly enough. Maybe that's a bit of fatigue or something, mental fatigue. I don't know if it'll be tactical. They were trying to snap at them early up the pitch to stop them being able to play through them. But Liverpool were so good. You saw it, and there's a few occasions when they passed through lines with little triangles, which again, Chelsea would have played, like known how to defend against in Liverpool's half. But when you do it really well, it doesn't really matter how well you're coached on it. They're able to go past you sometimes. Yeah. But then you lose the ball in midfield.
Yeah, I know. It's interesting. There was a commentator made a point one moment in the game. It sounds like a rather obvious one. But to say if Chelsea had Liverpool's front three, then they'd be, 10-0 ahead. It really did feel like that. You make the point before that there were lots of sloppy midfields, mistakes from midfield. It did seem, however, though, Seb, every time the ball got to Mohamed Salah, and including for the wonderful goal that he scored, Chelsea were threatened massively.
Yeah, I mean, the point about the front three is like, I don't know, because I felt as if Liverpool could have put that game away. I know Chelsea hit them with two goals at the end of the first half, but at the beginning of the second, Sadio Mane found himself in a couple of good positions, so did Salah, and there were just a few of those kind of mental mistakes that you associate with fatigue. I'm not nearly smart enough to explain the link between fatigue and decision making, but it seemed as if a fresher Liverpool front three would have capitalised. But it was interesting. Is this you leading me on to talk about Romelu Lukaku? Have I read that right?
No, not at all.
No, I mean,
you can salvage that though. Go on. I believe in you.
No, I don't know, but I felt like some of those bad decisions were also part of what made this fun, because you saw, for instance, Liverpool, like Mane getting into space and then almost playing in a kind of ad-libbing way. The structure doesn't exist around him. The kind of the Liverpool's patterns of movement around a ball carrier weren't quite what they might be. And it felt a little bit at times as if, no, Jürgen Klopp, obviously, Pep Linders was in the technical area. Liverpool felt a little bit like they were on a day out with a substitute teacher, because it was very, very fluid and very aggressive and disjointed at times. And it was kind of fun. But then I felt maybe as if, they lacked a little bit of efficiency to kill Chelsea off, because Chelsea had maybe 20 good minutes in the game. Didn't feel like they had a lot of thrust through the middle. I think Pulisic scored, but I don't think he had the very best game. Havertz was a little bit frustrating. I thought just on the midfield thing, I thought it was really interesting that that the game kind of was killed stone dead as soon as Jorginho came on. it comes on, there's just no more fun. It's just boring.
And so this is the point that JJ is referring to, the point at which Chelsea start to play a 5-3-2 or a 3-5-2 instead is when Jorginho is brought on. Doesn't change again until later with Hudson-Odoi, and then there's a bit more excitement after that as well. But it did. It felt like... it didn't feel necessarily like they were trying to settle for a draw. It looked like the substitutions were attacking in nature, but it did have that effect of kind of killing the game a little bit.
It's sort of tactical. It's the difference with, like, it doesn't matter what your tactics are. Like, if you, certain players will change the way your team plays. Mm. And Jorginho gives you control of the midfield. And at that point in the game, it's been absolutely haywire crazy for all the way through it. You put Jorginho on and you can slow things down a little bit, get the extra pass out from the back or get the extra pass in the opposition third so that you don't have to worry so much about turnovers, because when your players are tired towards the end of the game, that's when you're more susceptible to being caught in transition.
Yeah. And Liverpool were missing that without Thiago as well, which I know people have differing opinions about him and whether he's able to sort of impact a game in a positive attacking sense. But one of the things that he's certainly brilliant at is slowing the pace of the game down, controlling it a little bit, making sure that, you know, in some ways, this Liverpool midfield looked like the Liverpool midfield of two seasons ago when they, admittedly were winning the league, but they were doing it with far more turnovers and, you know, far more transitions.
Yeah, it was really fun to watch. Yeah. I much prefer this than the... I disagree with Seb. I think Chelsea were the better team throughout the whole thing. I think Liverpool scored two, not against the run of play, but just managed to score because they have probably better individuals up front. Mane's really out of form. He hasn't been the same player for a long time. I think he was doing all the, like, he's working hard and seems to be in the right places, but there's a couple of things when he wasn't reacting to, like a ball going across the box or wasn't quite in the right place at the right time. I think I can't figure out Pulisic. I can't figure out what really he is.
Needs to stay fit. I mean, like, he needs to, he seems fragile. It doesn't seem like he ever plays way into having that kind of definition. Because I agree with you.
He's also playing in two different positions regularly, right? He's playing a right wing back for Chelsea and also occasionally as part of that front three. A little bit of consistency would be useful.
You can't really rely on, I don't think you can rely on him to be consistent, but he can win a game for you. Mm-hmm. There's he's always capable of a little spark of magic. And the weird thing is that often in, like, the best teams, they don't have a lot of players who do that sort of thing because it's too risky. Yeah. Like, I don't remember, for instance, like a Jose Mourinho team that's ever had a player like that in it, because you can't control it. But it also then is often the reason either that you win or lose. and you'd hope it would be the reason that you win. And there was a couple of times when I think it was maybe Havertz or Pulisic. They'd obviously been coached to press in a certain way to when Liverpool are playing out. Again, it's really high. And they're trying to show the first ball out to the defender and then they were cutting off the lane back to the goalkeeper then trying to cut the other lanes off. And Liverpool were really good at playing through it. There was a couple of times when I think it was Mount was starting the press and looking around to his left and seeing that the other people hadn't done it, Pulisic and Havertz hadn't done exactly what they were supposed to. And that's problematic because then that's a failure of, I don't know, is it the individual or the coaching of it? I don't know, it must be annoying. Very frustrating, I think, for Tuchel to watch that. But I thought Chelsea were excellent in this game. I thought they were really unlucky to win it.
They were good. And I suppose, perhaps it's an easy thing to say, Seb, but there were a number of chances that they created where you felt, I mean, we mentioned Pulisic. He was... he was on the end of three or four chances, some which he'd helped create, some which he just happened to be there for, that didn't turn into goals. And part of me couldn't help but think if Lukaku was there, they may have scored more.
Yeah, I suppose the natural response to that is, yes, I agree. But then also, if Lukaku's playing, Chelsea's system looks a little bit different. Do they create those chances against that Liverpool defence? I don't know. Or do they... are they tuned slightly towards his skill set or more towards his skill set? So, yeah, but it was always going to be the elephant in the room no matter what happened in the game. But, like...
Let me ask you this then. Like, forget about the situation specifically. We can't... Obviously, as I said, we're recording this on a Monday. The story's probably going to change by the time the podcast goes out. So I'd rather ask a slightly different question about Lukaku. Very clearly a fantastic player, elite-level striker, could score, double-figure goals in any top five league, right? That goes without saying. Is he a Tuchel player?
I don't know because I'm not sure I believe in that kind of definition. Like, I think part of coaching is learning how to adapt or using resources in different ways. And He should be a Tuchel player because Lukaku will always score goals wherever he goes, has done. Comes off probably the richest period of his career in Italy. I know it's a different league and a different style of football, and he played in a different system. But you have all these really interesting attacking pieces. Many of them are different. We talked about Pulisic, but the obvious ones, Havertz, Mount, Ziyech doesn't get mentioned very often. I think he's Werner, interesting in a kind of sort of slightly more haphazard way, but still provides a lot of pace. I wonder whether it's a, I wonder whether this is a little bit about age profile, because if you think about the group of players that we've just mentioned, particularly Havertz, Werner, and Mount, they're all around the same age. Lukaku is 29 now, I believe.
Is he 29? Lukaku's
not. Yeah, he's been around, and he's been around forever, because he I think he was signed by Chelsea initially 16, when he was when he was 16, 17. Yeah. Was at West Brom as a teenager, so he's been scoring goals for a long time. Lukaku is not a long-term 4 or 5 year player for Chelsea. He's just not going to be. And so you wonder whether, I don't know, I mean, the story will play out, as we said, and it will evolve in the next couple of days, but it seems a little bit like a man out of time in more than one way, possibly. But I don't know. I mean, we talk about whether he's a Tuchel player, but I think he's done some pretty good things for Chelsea. He hasn't been a natural fit for the system. I think that's obvious. There have been times when he's been isolated, when he's kind of fallen back into that weird sort of reductive target man role that he seemed to play sometimes for Manchester United. It's not that he can't do it. It's just it's such an obvious way of diluting his impact, because that's just one aspect of a pretty multifaceted skill set. But he's had good moments. He's scored important goals. He has provided momentum and decent contributions. He was pretty good when he came on at Villa Park. So I don't know. It's a very weird story for all sorts of reasons.
Okay. One more thing to say, excuse me, about this game before we move on. A conversation that Seb and I were having at the time, actually. But I'll ask you about this, JJ, because we didn't ask you, and I'm curious to know what you think. Wish I hadn't said it like that, but I have, and I won't go back. I said to Seb, watching the game, I thought Trent Alexander-Arnold had a bit of a poor game. At times, I think he made a couple of really key passes. He assisted Salah for the goal. He had what I would think of, in terms of my experience, as a bit of a Trent Alexander-Arnold game. One or two fantastic moments, and then also like a number of mistakes as well. And it struck me whilst watching that the thing that really sets apart like the proper elite level players from players who could be that or are just very, very good is that a consistency. Bit of a cliche, but I said that to Seb as Salah scored that near post goal, which is a goal that he's never ever going to miss. It's also, he did it with such ease as to make himself look very obviously like the best player in the world. When you stand that next to a player like of Trent's ability, you begin to realize the importance that that kind of consistency has, right? And that's what people were always talking about when it came to Ronaldo or Messi or Lewandowski.
I don't think he had a bad game at all. I thought he was one of their better players.
Did you really?
Yeah.
That's very surprising to me.
The thing is, though, you're going to give the ball away if you're trying things and you're playing out from the back. Like, things like that are going to happen sometimes. We've talked about this before. We did a video on it. Like, there are certain things in his game defensively that do let him down. He's not a bad defender. He is a good defender. But there are certain times when he doesn't go in with the right body positioning, or he's just a bit weak in the tackle, because he's basically a very cultured, skillful midfielder who can play that right wing-back role because he's got an amazing engine and can just run up and down. He reads the game so well, so he's able to play in defence. Like some of the cleverest players you'll get will play in defence because they read the game so well, they're ahead of the game. But he's most of the time, he's in the opposition half as a winger or as an inside forward playing in the half space. He comes into midfield an awful lot as well. I thought he was decent in this game. There was the obvious one earlier where there was a mistake. I think he was get caught and Havertz missed that 1v1 with the goalie. When he's put through, you know, the one early in the game?
Yeah.
I can't remember exactly who it was, yeah.
I just remember that happening. I remember that happening a few times. I remember thinking as halftime approached and saying to Seb, I didn't think he was having a very good game. But I mean, I very well might be wrong. Seb, what do you think?
Well, I felt like my response to him was conditioned by how prominent Marcus Alonso was. And I know Chelsea's system probably favoured that. But it felt like Alonso was really the perfect player to... We accept like some of the defensive shortcomings in Trent's game because the payoff is is so obviously in his favor. Like he's brilliant on the ball, and JJ's absolutely right. Like he is there to take risks and he's there to take chances. He's not just there to shovel the ball 5 yards to his side or back towards center halves. But I don't think he did a particularly good job against Alonso, and Alonso was as good as I've seen him this season. So I don't know. I don't know. Maybe it was just that. Maybe it was just a little bit of a bias there. I'm not sure.
I think a lot of managers, you always say that teams target Alexander-Arnold. I don't know if that's true or not. What they definitely target is the space between him and the centre-back next to him. And that's because of positioning, because he plays so high up the pitch. And I think you accept the risk of him doing bad things that give the ball away or little mistakes for all the good that you get out of him.
A bit like a sort of Fernandez scenario where you can make those aggressive passes without worry.
Like, I think Reece James is a much better defender, but Reece James can play at centre back as well. We're talking about like English right backs, whatever. I don't know why. I mean, didn't play in this game, obviously, but look at the difference. Azpilicueta is nowhere near as good going forward as Alexander Arnold, who's also playing at this, you know, similar position ish. It's not quite the same, and the systems are slightly different. But if you've got Alonso, who is a tall guy who can go inside the pitch, likes to get on the end of crosses as well as so the game plan I thought from Chelsea. Of all the other obvious things, pressing high, whatever, was to keep switching play. This is something that like Aston Villa did when they pumped them. Was it like 7-2 or something like that? Some crazy score last season or whenever the crowds went in. I can't remember what it was. And Dean Smith talking about, well, we know the way they play and the way they go back into their defensive shape. You just switch the ball around a lot. And you'll often catch like wing back to wing back. So Azpilicueta to Alonso or something. But you've got Pulisic. So Havertz is effectively a false nine, right? He was playing, he goes quite advanced in the press, but then he drops into little slots and fills gaps when they're in possession. But Pulisic wants to get in behind because he's a really quick player. And sure enough, like he gets in between that space. Graham Souness pointed out how Virgil van Dijk stays level pretty much with Konate when Pulisic goes in to score the goal that he scores. And Souness suggested that he should be coming across to tackle him. He may well be right. I don't know if there's varying lines of thought you can have on this. He said it looked kind of lazy to him, as though van Dijk was just doing that. It looked more to me like he was just trying to hold his position. He probably should have come across to block it, but that's easy by hindsight because you see where Pulisic's going. But there was too much space between van Dijk and Alexander-Arnold in the first place. But van Dijk's normally the left side of centre-back. It should be Konate is there. So it's a little breakdown all over the defence. It was kind of odd. But yeah, back to the original question.
I think that's very, very interesting. Maybe that this is the case then where I watch a player who, I don't know, loses the ball a few times or doesn't make the tackle I want them to make. I assume that means they've had a bad game. I can see the light now, JJ. Thank you.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
We're back from the break. Arsenal 1-2 Manchester City. Interesting game. Dogged by talk of VAR, referee decisions, and, we'll get on to talk about the game because Arsenal had a very a good performance, I thought, and you know everyone seems to be the general consensus afterwards, so we can discuss that. Something I felt at the time, and I tweeted, got a lot of heat on the Twitter on Saturday. Didn't intend this. I thought in my mind when Man City got the penalty, I thought, oh, we should just get rid of penalties because I hate them. I think they're rubbish. Often they're not really deserved. With VAR, I'm not saying, don't take my comment as to be a reflection of this specific game, because I think, you know, the incidents were all, technically were all accurate, right? But we all here know that with VAR, you can pretty much get a penalty for almost anything, right? If you slow something down enough and look at it, there's been indiscretion
here. I quite like this theory, Joe. But I was thinking about it, and what do you replace it with? Because you can't take away fouls.
Well, I don't know.
So, destroy people.
This is the next suggestion, isn't it? The point I'm making. Look, if someone hacks someone down just in front of the 6-yard box when there's no goalkeeper there, and they're obviously going to score a goal very clearly. I would say just give them the goal for a start. Get rid of the penalty. Just give them a goal or give them the penalty. That's fine. But when a penalty is given, when you're just in the corner of the 18-yard box and there's a minor indiscretion, which you've had to look at six different camera angles to decide whether it was even a problem or not, how is that a penalty? How do you then get in a situation where you have an 80% chance of scoring a goal when there could have been, the context could have been anything? There could have been no one between you and the goal. There could have been 20 players between you and the goal. Like, it's not the same scenario each time. And so I think what a penalty is given for has to change, particularly when you get to the byline, the ball's about to go out. So in this instance, the one where Arsenal, Ødegaard's one that wasn't given, Edison comes out and makes a tackle towards the ball. He gets the ball. It looks like he also gets the player. Either way, the ball is going out, right? That is not going to be a goal, whether there's a foul or not. If Edison doesn't get there, it's not going to be a cross. It's just going out. So how, in what, even if it was a foul, in what world should Arsenal be given an 80% chance of goal immediately after that? It just doesn't make any sense. Like, the outcome is totally out of whack with the I can't think of the, you understand what I'm saying? Someone else talk.
Well, they can have some sort of heat map thing where so that part of the penalty area would be green,
yeah,
as in light, and then it can get more colourful as it goes towards the areas where you're more likely to score. And I bet that'd be really fun to watch on VAR as they dissect which particular pixel ball was in.
That would be cool, huh? I'd like that.
It would take forever and be even worse than it is when they're looking at whether Odegaard dived or not.
Yeah. I think maybe there should be like a... we could probably do this with computers now. If you would somehow make the 18-yard, the entire 18-yard box would be made out of like tech turf, where you could tell exactly where any transgression had taken place. And the VAR were there to decide how bad it was out of a scale of 1 to 100. You get the robots to do it. Don't get the real people to do it. And then you have 1,000 different possible scenarios for what a penalty decision could be. Are there players in between you and the shot? Is it indirect? Is it direct? Whereabouts do you take it from? And it's all based on how probable you are to score from wherever that is, based on the probability that you would have scored or created a goal-scoring opportunity from where you were. I think in 10 years' time, with better technology and more data, and that's how we work out XG, right? Like all through the same sorts of means. In 10 years' time, we could do that. We could create, every penalty would be a sort of unique scenario that would just be decided by a computer, and it would only take 10 seconds, so it wouldn't be this nonsense where you have to wait around for 30 seconds. One of the things that ruined yesterday's game for me, the Chelsea-Man City game, Chelsea-Liverpool game, was how even after the Kovacic goal, for example, they all had to wait. Like, they all celebrated a bit, and then the crowd and the players completely die down for 30 seconds, and then the atmosphere sort of returns. I don't know. Maybe it's like an old man shouting at a cloud, but...
Yeah, I've got bored there halfway through.
Yeah, I could see. Thanks for looking so bored. Obviously so bored while I was talking.
Like on JJ's pixel nightmare, what I enjoyed after this game was that obviously the two different fan bases clearly took the footage, slowed it down to a kind of an eighth of its speed. And I saw one Manchester City fan arguing that, in fact, Odegaard had stamped on Edison and should have been red carded. And an Arsenal fan saying, no, this is clearly a penalty. It's the most egregious, trip I've ever seen. And it was just so beyond the spirit of the game that it's ridiculous. It's kind of, it provides those margins into which kind of fans' paranoia and conspiracy just floods with devastating effect. But your idea, Joe, so I remember watching a Copa America I was a teenager, so it would have been like the 90s. And whichever country was hosting, the penalty boxes were a different cut of grass. It looked as if before the tournament, they'd all been replaced because maybe 6-yard boxes had been worn or something. Mm. So you had this kind of distinguishing feature, which probably made IDing penalties and finding out, obviously this is pre-VAR and, pre-technology of football. So you could do that a little bit. You could have different cuts of grass and 6-yard box, and sure, kind of the radius around the...
Yeah. I think, forget about all of the, the potential far-flung opportunities here. The main reason I bring this up is because, for me, and I know this is a subjective take, after Man City were given the penalty, the game was boring. Like, it was a boring outcome. I didn't enjoy it. It didn't feel like it was what was deserved based on the patterns of play. Most people responded to my tweet accusing me of being a crying Arsenal fan. I understand why that would be the case. I don't support Arsenal.
Nail on the head there, to
sure,
be fair.
Like, I mean, don't support Arsenal. I don't care what happens. This is the other thing. If Man City come back and win the game, I don't care. I just don't want the penalty to be the reason why. It just makes the game boring. And then what was very interesting to me, JJ, was after that point, everything, you know, all the kind of bullet-pointed drama moments that were discussed after the game were all from that penalty onwards, as if those were the incidents that I was supposed to be impressed or excited by within the game. When what I was actually impressed and excited by was mostly, in this instance, it happened to be the way that Arsenal were playing before that occurred, before that incident completely changed the outcome of the game. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit you screaming at the clouds. I really enjoyed this game from start to finish. I get that the penalty annoys you, but this is because you didn't want Man City to win.
This is the problem. When anyone has a new idea, someone goes, "Oh, it's because of that," and you're not allowed for it to not be that. I couldn't care less which of these teams win. I really don't care. I just felt like it was just a stupid thing. What was the point in this?
So I think that sort of penalty in the game, say, like, I thought Arsenal were the better team for ages in this game. Probably all the way through it, I thought they were so well set up for this, and the team worked really hard, had a great shape, showed the ball where they wanted it, always wide, then started the press, and then won the ball back really well. And they were attacking with, like, really good combinations and, like you're saying, patterns of play that were just lovely. Like, put that third man run stuff they're doing, and they're playing the progressive pass rather than the short one. It was good. But, like, big teams, like the teams who always win stuff, always get these stupid penalties. They just always do. Like, I've watched it for 1,000 years in the Scottish Premiership with Rangers and Celtic. Well, it doesn't matter if you're the better team. Aberdeen can be, what, like, 1-0 up, 2-0 up. You know that at some point they're going to get one of these stupid penalties because it's just built into
the world. Wouldn't you rather it wasn't a thing?
Well, yeah, but then it just is a thing.
JJ's just broken over Christmas.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, like, just imagine. I know football can't change.
He was so cheerful and happy, and he was the kind of, like, there was all this life in him, and now,
there's,
like,
no hope for Aberdeen.
Look into his eyes, they're just dead.
My life's falling apart.
Just imagine for a moment that things could change. Imagine football where penalties weren't, like, stupid penalties, as you described them, just weren't a thing. Wouldn't it be better?
I know, but there's always someone going to let you down.
Well, that is true.
Was the City penalty so silly? I mean,
Bernardo
Silva goes down very easily. I understand that. And I'd be really, really annoyed if that was given against my team. But at the same time, it gets given because there's that frame in it where the footage stops and everybody in the world can see that Granit Xhaka is just needlessly grabbing his shirt. It's a penalty. Like,
it's a tiny bit clumsy, but enough to foul him. Yeah, I agree.
It's a tax on his laziness. Like, he could. Oh, 100%. It's just poor defensive technique.
Hey,
like,
and the rules currently stand, 100% a penalty. It is. I just wish there were no penalties.
I understand, and it's kind of, it's a really, like, from a, given the kind of the scale of effect it had, or the level of effect it had on the game, I get it. It's a really silly minor offense, but, like, there's no Tottenham Arsenal thing at work here, I promise. It's just like, I don't see the raging controversy in it.
Oh, there is no raging controversy.
No,
not at all.
Well, I've seen sort of petitions and this referee must never officiate ever again because he did this. And it's like, well...
No, sorry, apologies. There was a raging... there was controversy. I thought you meant as related to what I was saying. I'm not
biting back at you. I just it's a funny one. It feels like there always has to be a controversy, and whether there is one or not, we're going to make one. And it was a penalty, and it was also a red card. And I have seen the Odegaard Edison incident probably about 20-25 times in slow motion, and I still don't really know whether he touched the ball or he didn't. And if that's the case, then it probably shouldn't be a penalty.
No, for sure.
The
one thing that was weird in that game for me, which I suppose added to the arguments about the referee, was when Martinelli misses the open goal, you know, when he clips the post, takes it too quickly. When you look at you slow down the replay, look at where the ref goes. He runs right in front of him.
That was unfair.
That's
like
just
that was
weird. Why?
But it was just unfortunate. Also, yeah, like yeah. Let's be fair. He should still score.
Oh, 100%. Yeah.
It's he was mildly inconvenienced by the referee who was trying to get himself in good position.
It's just a funny situation.
Mildly. Yeah. But it was weird because if you look at it from a certain angle, it's like he is kind of it's like he's obstructing him deliberately. He's running, he's changes the direction of his run.
There you go, this is interesting. Not to prolong a long and boring conversation about a VAR, but it is interesting, isn't it? You point out there every decision was the correct one, and yet the controversy surrounding those decisions appears greater even than it would have been potentially. Maybe that's a rose-tinted glasses. Greater even than it might have been without VAR. The sort of VAR element just extends the conversation.
Well, I think it's because VAR becomes an event in itself. So when you have the stoppages, and you spoke about the Kovacic one, you have moments in which everyone can kind of formulate their own opinions. Everyone gets angry and starts to froth because, well, quite rightly, with Kovacic, because the natural energy of the moment drains away because everyone's sitting there going, oh, just, know your place, VAR. This is,
I think we all said if that goal came back, the Kovacic one, if that was ruled out, yeah, we were all going to turn the telly off.
Yeah, it generally was, yeah.
Yeah, because it also feels like if a football game is a play and it's divided into different acts, then the VAR stoppages become acts in themselves. Mm. There was I was watching Elche against Granada on Sunday, and I was watching the highlights on Sunday night, and the Finnish goalless, but there was an Elche goal which was disallowed for just a nonsense offence. People can go and watch it. But it honestly took 5 minutes to come to the conclusion, which was incorrect anyway. And within that time, you have the opportunity to harness all of your dislike for what's going on, and it becomes as memorable a moment as your response to a goal or a red card or something that exists within football naturally. And so that's why I think this VAR becomes not a tool to adjudicate it. It becomes a prop within the game itself, which is very,
I think,
very
if the goal's amazing, then they shouldn't ever be allowed to go to the robots. It should only be like that's, yeah. Like the Kovacic one, you're just like, well, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if he's like attacked the keeper. It's got to count because it's so
See,
good.
See, on that note, I keep thinking back to, I'm blanking on his name, Florentino Perez and his interview on the eve of the downfall of the Super League, where he floats the possibility that football games could be shorter than 90 minutes, right? And it's a ridiculous interview, and he talks about it in a ridiculous way. But at the same time, I can't help but think, right? Maybe, in a way, maybe he was right. Because since that moment, since the Super League, all I've done is watch football games and actually think for the first time, how could this be less boring? And this is honestly where the penalties thing comes from, because that just, it's subjective. It may not be the case for Seb or JJ or for people listening. For me, I find them boring. And if they weren't there, I might enjoy the game more. And I'm thinking, not about what is probable or realistic in terms of rule changes or evolution of the game. But it just strikes me that there's quite a lot about it, about most games, that are really dull, and it's working out whether the balance of kind of dull is required for the drama. Do you know what I mean? Like the moments of up and down.
Well, because the thing that annoys me there is not the length of the game itself. It's when parts of the game get stolen away by things like time wasting or officials failing to add minutes on at the end of games. So I think we're at opposite ends. But your solution isn't to shorten the game, because all of you just condense all of the things that you dislike into a smaller space, probably exaggerating their effect, I would have thought.
It's also because your millennial brain has trained you to want things like to be constantly changing.
For sure.
And new.
Yeah.
Like you watch donkey videos and some of them will be 2 minutes, some of them will be four. You'll watch them all. But like, you can get instant hits of that lovely little dopamine thing you get. Or like Twitter, everything's changing all the time. A constant stream of information. Whereas football means you have to watch an entire thing for ages, and sometimes not a lot of stuff happens. And think about the highlights of football games. Like, so you can watch a football game on Twitter now because the goals come up. It doesn't really matter what happens for most of it, because you can pretty much guess Liverpool are better than Watford, so they're probably going to have more of the ball. Oh, look, they've scored two. Salah's got two. One of them's really good. So you can consume the goal, the game that way. I think that's sort of touching on what Perez will be talking about and how younger people consume the game. A lot of younger people don't watch football at all. They just play FIFA.
Yeah.
I genuinely, and this is a lot of This has gone on for about 5-6 years, I think. I remember looking at it when I used to work at the Telegraph. There was the guy in charge of the Premier League then, whatever his name was.
Richard
Skinner. Generic man. Him, yeah. And then they were saying how one of the biggest threats to, I guess, the Premier League and just football generally is esports and kids coming, growing up, playing football video games and preferring that to the actual thing. Because then the players are still relevant because they're real, you know, and you have to, they have to be real to exist within the game. But those games are shorter. They're 10 minutes. They're 10-minute turnarounds, 5 minutes and a half, and that's what they're used to. Whereas then you expect a kid, like a child, to sit down and watch a whole 90 minutes. They're not used to doing that sort of thing. Yeah. And it's very different. I wonder if that...
I think that's 100% true. I will say I think there is a slight degree of difference. I can read a long, boring book without being as bored. You know, so I think there are still. It doesn't change the fact that
it engages you mentally, though, I guess, isn't it?
Yeah, there's something to engage with.
Invent the images yourself.
It's not passive. Football, when you watch it at home on the television, can be quite passive, particularly if you're not a fan of either team.
Yeah, a good way to do it as well when you're watching is not have your phone on you, because then you're looking at that. People are always looking on Twitter and trying to like say things to be like the funniest or like observe the thing the most. It doesn't matter. It's Twitter. Who cares? It's other people shouting into a void.
Because I watch on German Sky, I've got a little bit of a delay. So I'm probably about a minute and a half behind the British footage. So I have to stay off Twitter most of the time. And I've noticed, actually, my enjoyment of the game and appreciation for it improves dramatically. And yeah, I'm someone that I don't think I could watch enough football during a weekend, or the week. But having the phone there, it kind of puts you in this strange netherworld between the football and between social media where you're not really properly engaged in either and you're not really enjoying either for what they actually are, I think. And it's I think most people would say the same, because that's become a kind of, when you're not in the ground itself, and most grounds 4G just doesn't work, so you can't do it. When you're not in the ground itself, it's very easy just to kind of disengage with what is ultimately like a two-dimensional experience.
Phones are the problem. I knew it all along.
What's really stuck with me about the kind of the Super League and some of the arguments that were made against it, particularly those ones about how you engage children and how you find the next generation of fans, like, at what point does making sure that they can afford to go not come up in the conversation?
Yeah, like, or I afford to watch it on TV. Like, well, yeah, but this, like, my dad's account is so expensive.
The way that people like Florentino Perez and Andrea Agnelli will contort themselves to come up with new ideas, and yet they never seem to arrive at, I don't know, how about we make sure that they're exposed to the full range of sensory experiences that football offers at a really young age? Because that's what does it for most people. Like, I don't love football because once upon a time I turned on the channel at the right time. It was because I got to go to it when it was, you know, you didn't have to remortgage the house to do it. And that's kind of, I'm not saying that all these other initiatives aren't worthy and these aren't questions that are worth asking. I just, there's a hierarchy of questions that you need to ask. Ones with greater priority than others, and, you know, turning it into, you know, two halves into eight eights and making them all like 7 minutes and 45 seconds long, you know, we can try that, but maybe make it affordable first.
Well, that's where the phrase "the game's gone" is entirely applicable, because, I mean, the money horse has bolted. What the hell's a money horse? But it's gone, right? The money horse.
Nee.
But it's many chariots of gold, right? So, I mean, I used to go to the football with my dad, and he bought me, like, a child season ticket, because they have cheaper ones at Aberdeen, which I don't know how
much it costs. Was this a couple of years ago, 1 or 2 years ago? Because you do have a young face, don't you? I know listeners at home, viewers, they might not realize you're actually 56 years old, because you do look like a 16-year-old boy.
When you go to the football, people think it was two children stacked on top of each other. Is that because you're so tall?
Yeah, four children,
Yeah. But that's the thing. So the money, right? So if I was trying to take someone's child to the football in London, right? Which I'm not doing.
No, sure.
You can't afford it. It's madness. Even like trying to take like one of my friends wants to go. He's never been to a football game, the Premier League team. And it was like, well, first of all, you got to sign up to be a member. Like, it's like the closest one to me is probably Arsenal, right? So to go and watch Arsenal, you'd be a red member unless you go to like a shitty League Cup game. No one cares about that, not even Arsenal fans. And so you have to be a red member, or you get lucky with some rubbish game that no one wants to go to, Europa League versus, I don't know, some team from Lithuania or something. And then Sutinac's Premier League game, you have to be a member, then you have to try and get two memberships because you can't get two tickets next to each other. And then the ticket costs at least 50 quid, probably like 60, 70. It's obscene for how much it costs, which is just unsustainable. But you can't then go, as like Perez or whoever, can't then go to the league committee and say, this might have got a bit out of hand about 25 years ago. Maybe we should take this down so we can pay the players less. They'll love that. And let the TV companies make even more money because they'll make the same amount of money that they do, and we'll just lower that. And then I really suspect the Saudi Arabian government is definitely going to be really on board for lowering all these sorts of bits and pieces. Like, you're competing with people who are multi-billionaires from like all countries around the world competing in the same league, and the league is now owned by them. And another thing about the Super League, like, this weekend was amazing football. Arsenal Man City was great fun to watch. Chelsea Liverpool was great fun to watch. I would rather it was that every week. It was the best.
What we've done is we've spent the entire time, it's my fault, talking about stuff which is not actually how good Arsenal were. Sorry, I can see the comments now will be, I can't believe how much they hate Arsenal. They refused to talk about how good they were. So Seb, as a Spurs fan, let me just ask you for 2 minutes to tell everyone how good Arsenal were in this game and how nice it is to see them not being so bad all the time.
It was nice, in inverted commas, to see them not being a victim in this kind of game. Sure. Like, I know they lost, and I know the events which led them to lose have kind of overshadowed everything. But it's really good to see how aggressive they were in the press.
They took it to them.
Good to see
them.
They
took it to them.
Well, yeah, but they did, and they attacked with some real personality. They created the best chances in the game. I thought Martinelli had a good game. I thought Lacazette played well. It was really, after the game finished, I looked up where Arsenal were playing their attacking third passes. There's a lot of activity just in front of the Man City box and the kind of the area inside and in front of the D, which if you think back like a year and a half ago, when Arsenal were in that phase where all they did was cross the ball in their kind of their donut of sadness, lump the ball into the box, headed away, cleared, don't score any goals. I know it didn't end well, but Arsenal seemed very, very potent. And hey, I'll put it this way. Arsenal and Spurs are playing the second North London derby of the season in 2 weeks' time, and this worried me. So praise indeed.
There you go. Good to worry, Seb. Did we do a second break yet?
No.
Well, let's do one now.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
Ah, returning. Watford 0-1 Spurs. Seb, you've written in the plan here that Tottenham were fairly unimpressive and slow. But I thought I remembered reading something about their record since Conte arrived, so I had a quick look. Only one loss since Man United on the 30th of October, and that was in, of course, in the Europa Conference League. Conte undefeated, basically.
Yeah, no quibble at all with Antonio Conte's work. I just think that this was one of the games which, kind of perfect result, because they won it, but it also showed all of their flaws pretty vividly. Spurs were very, very stale. The crossing and the final third distribution was really poor and unoriginal. It seemed like it might be one of those fatigue things we talked about earlier where it just kind of drains all the creativity out of you. But at the same time, I felt like it exposed, for instance, I'm not sure Emerson Royale is quite the right. It was bought to be a fullback, bought to be a wingback for Nuno Espirito Santo, is now playing as a different kind of wingback under Antonio Conte. Doesn't seem particularly suited to it. Takes a little bit too long. Good player. And a developing one because he's still pretty young, but don't know, not convinced by that. I also think that whilst I can make the case for Lucas, Son, and Kane playing together as a three, I think one of them has to be sacrificed, and it would be Lucas for more of a distributor slash playmaker slash someone who can pass the ball reliably into the penalty box, because there's just not enough variation to Tottenham's game. And that's going to be a problem. Conte's doing great work, but he has to, it's like a chef, you've got to give them the right ingredients, don't you? So let's see.
Okay, fine. Well, Watford nil in this game. Of course, I think that is now 9 out of the 10 games that Ranieri has managed that they've lost. It's looking very, very bad for them. They are hovering just above the relegation zone. There's only about 3 points, I think, between Norwich in last and Watford in 17th, JJ. They look like a relegation candidate for sure.
Well, they did when they came up. Their team, their squad's not very good. And they, one of their best players was Will Hughes, and they sold him. I don't think there's much analysis needed. Their players aren't that good. And they are probably going to go down.
Great. Well, it was to segue. Yeah.
Well, I don't know that...
Dennis is great, though.
Dennis is my segue into AFCON, but we'll come back to that.
Oh, I thought they played quite well against Spurs. Like they lost, yes, and they lost to a really well-delivered free kick and the one really quality moment of attack and play that Spurs put together. Defended quite well. They broke quite well. They broke well enough to cause a few problems. Josh King might have scored, brought a really, really good save from Hugo Lloris early in the second half. Might have had a penalty. Shouldn't have had a penalty, but might have done. So I just don't think... I don't think those players are necessarily playing that badly. I just don't think they're quite good enough. And they need, like JD's bang on, like you need someone to replace Will Hughes. I think they need someone. They haven't replaced Doucouré since he left. It's been a while now. He's an excellent player, was for Watford, was a talisman there. They need to invest and they need to kind of... I don't think Ranieri is doing a bad job. I don't think the answer here is just, right, bin Ranieri. And because it's Watford and because of their pattern of sackings and hirings, that's what everyone assumes will happen next.
And there's surely so many different managers, players that they've brought in over time. So there's no coherence.
It's a real muddle, that squad.
So I haven't seen this game, so I don't know what happened. What I would assume would have happened, and you can correct me because I'm very likely to be wrong. But Watford, I'd imagine, played in this like 4-4-2 kind of block. And they sat kind of deep, nice and compact, and then tried to break in the spaces behind the wing backs to get balls into the box for two strikers. Is that how it worked?
Yeah, pretty much. Right. They were very, very deep. Yeah.
And this is the thing, you could get, I'm picking them randomly, Shrewsbury, right? Say Spurs are playing against them. They could do a similar sort of job. It's hard to break down a team in two banks of four who defend well and show the ball wide. Like, if you're professional footballers, you can do that quite well. It's just a... if you rely on that all season, it's very difficult to get more than 1 point a game on average. And so you're really in trouble.
One of the things that did impress me about Watford is one of the features of Conte's time at Chelsea was the way that his players would lock their opposition within their own final third. There was just no exit. And Spurs had that for about probably an hour. There was a period where they dominated the first half without, kind of stale domination. But Watford managed to seize a little bit of momentum and a bit of territory, and the game became a little bit more even for probably about 15 or 20 minutes in the second half. And I thought, hey, that's good coaching and that's good kind of tactical discipline from players, because you've understood what's going wrong. You understood that you can't just play like that for 90 minutes, but without something going wrong with Kane and Son and, whoever else. It was just unlucky. The game plan worked and they deserved a point. They were due one for their performance. I just think you have to have a bit more in midfield. It's kind of simple, I think. Just need to have a bit more ability. Because I think that gets rid of the inferiority complex that you can develop as a team. If you know you're not good enough, if you're Norwich, or if you're Newcastle at the moment, or if you're Watford, And if you spend long enough listening to people telling you, well, you're just not good enough, then eventually you play like you're not good enough. You may play to instruction, but eventually it doesn't lead to anywhere good. And I feel like Watford could really do with, you know, a small army of reinforcements in January.
Yeah. Okay. Well, good news, I suppose, for Watford is, of course, that that Dennis has not been allowed to go to AFCON. That, Seb, can you explain this to me? There was a strange situation with the notice period.
Yeah, it's very, very strange. So this has happened with Dennis. It's also, as we're recording this, there seems to be a very, very strange situation with Sarr as well, who's not going. Watford are being accused of... I don't fully understand the Dennis situation, so I'm not going to try and explain it. But Watford have been accused of disrespecting the tournament and prohibiting Sarr from being involved. Apologies if that proves not to be correct by tomorrow, but that's
no. I think that's the case. Well, as far as I'm aware, as the point where we're recording, Nigeria that were required to give something like 9 or 14 days notice, not only to the player that they were going to select him, but also to the club, and that is what they did not do. They did not, apparently, according to Watford, notify Watford that they would be selecting him before 14 days, and therefore Watford are allowed to not send him, which puts the player in a strange position because it sounds a lot, and Ranieri acknowledges this too, that Dennis wants to go. But he's also in a situation where he doesn't want to let his teammates down. The club have said no. He doesn't want to let the club down. They're obviously in a relegation battle, or at least, you know, are in relegation form halfway through the season. It's a really tough spot to be put in, isn't it?
Yeah, for the players, it's almost impossible because you can't really win. I don't have that much sympathy for Premier League clubs. So... there's a case in Germany. St. Pauli have lost probably their most influential player, Kofi Kiré. He's been called up by Ghana. And they're top of the Zweite Bundesliga at the moment. And without him, they're going to suffer. And they're probably going to... their chances of promotion are going to diminish as a result. There's been no complaint. Off he goes with our well wishes. Do the very best you can. Great honour for you. Congratulations. And St. Pauli are a different case. I understand that. They are a different type of football club. But as an attitude, I feel like good for you, because the message here is don't put the player in the situation where that has to happen. Because, like, as you said, Joe, you can't win. Like, if I have to choose between my club, my employer, and my national team, I lose somehow. And that's not
fair.
Also,
if you're Dennis and you're playing for a team, you're a good player and you're playing for a team that are potential relegation candidates, and they don't let you go. Mm. I mean, if that were me, I'm not saying that Dennis would feel this way, but if I were in that situation, I would question the loyalty that I should have to that team. Maybe I should go and join someone else, you know? I don't know.
Am I right in thinking as well that he's not even... He only just got called back into Nigeria squad recently because he's been playing so well. He wasn't really considered.
I think that's
so
right.
There's a fair chance he wouldn't even start, which might also help inform everyone's decision.
Sure. It is possible. It is possible. But don't get in the way of our anger, JJ. You don't want
to be realistic.
Good facts or realism to disrupt what could be the case. Anyway, for more on that, you should read Adam Leventhal's pieces, The Athletic. Adam Leventhal, of course, being the Watford correspondent for The Athletic. Very useful. That's where I found out everything I just said. So if it was wrong, then blame Adam, because it couldn't possibly be me misremembering. It's more likely to be him doing a bad job. AFCON, anyway, though, very exciting. We're going to do a little bit of AFCON coverage in the podcast over the next few weeks, Seb. Any games in particular or teams in particular that you're looking forward to watching?
No, I'm going to watch the whole lot because we spoke about
this. You're going to watch every game?
I'm going to try to. So you called me about this on Boxing Day, I think.
Yeah, which no time for
sleeping. The year before, well, the year before we actually spoke on Christmas Day, so this was an improvement.
Sure.
This led me to find out that the whole thing is being covered on DAZN in Germany, which is terrific news. So we're going to try and watch as much as possible from it, and then pick out the things which are interesting and discussion worthy as we go. I'm going to go in with no preconceptions, which is the best way with a football tournament, I think. I've got no loyalty to anyone. I just want to watch good football, and we will take it from there. So
I'm going to do it differently to you. I'm going to pick a country, and that will be
that's
the team
be
that
you.
I support. And then I'll support them as ferociously as I would support any team.
What's going to inform that choice? What's
I
your
don't
selection
know.
Criteria?
If listeners have any suggestions for me, I'd love to be tweeted at, or in whatever way you can get a message to me. Tell me which team I should follow. I'm curious to know.
And in whatever way you can get a message to me seems like a dangerous way to go with this.
In whatever way you can. Listen, I will accept bribes, of course, also. But I don't know. I'm curious. If I don't receive enough messages or whatever, I'll just pick one. But JJ, what about you? Are you going to watch some of the AFCON?
I'm going to watch ones that are on TV. I don't even know what channels.
Every single game is on Sky.
Oh, amazing. Then yes, I'll be watching quite a lot of it. Yeah, that'd be great. Go.
Exciting stuff. Lots of players will be missing, of course, as well. We've got Sadio Mane, Salah, Ziyech, Keita, Mahrez. I mean, the list does go on. And Didi Iheanacho, Traore, Bissouma, Benrahma, of course, who scored a lovely, had a lovely game over the weekend for West Ham. That's not written down here. It'll be interesting to watch. Isn't there a break? Isn't there a Premier League winter break?
There's not in the same sense as there is in in Italy and Germany.
In Scotland. No.
Okay, well, the next there are some games
you have they have a sort of a staggered break, so it's not a kind of a single period. Like you'll see that different teams play at different times if you look on the fixture list. It's going to be muddled this year because of there've been so many postponements, unfortunately, and obviously there are teams that there's, I think, League Cup semi-finals this week, FA Cup games at the weekend, so it's a break without really being a break. It's a break, but with lots of football matches.
Well, okay, there we go. We were going to talk about Everton and Brighton. I think we've probably run over time a little bit. Brighton, nonetheless, worth saying, still doing well. There we go. We'll get around to it. JJ, very quickly, Everton, I've read, are interested in signing Rangers Nathan Patterson. Who is that and what is he good at?
He's a young Scottish right back who can play at wing back as well. I think he's got a couple of caps for Scotland, might be more now, two or three. He's absolutely brilliant. I think he's going to be a really properly good player.
Well, Andy Robertson good?
Potentially. I mean, Robertson's good for a lot of reasons, like his physical abilities, his stamina, pace, but also his leadership capabilities. He's very aggressive, good footballer, Andy Robertson, but he's got more about him. He's like a captain. He is literally the captain of Scotland as well. Patterson is, I think, not appreciated for how skillful he is on the ball. He's dead young, but he'll happily Cruyff turn people on the wing, and his crossing is good. I wouldn't say it's spectacular, but he has all the attributes, I think, of a really good right back. Scotland really need one, so that's excellent timing that he's come through at the moment. But at Rangers, he can't get in the team because their captain is James Tavernier, who people might remember. He used to play at Newcastle, I think. He's certainly youth team, something like that, wasn't he? I think he was. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so he's the captain of Rangers. He's a top scorer in Scotland a couple of years ago because of loads of penalties, which is kind of nuts. And free kicks as well, he's good at those. But he can't really break into the team. And an argument that a lot of Rangers fans I've seen online have said is that, like Celtic did with Tierney, and I think they got rid of or stopped playing Izaguirre and they put Tierney in the team. And then Tierney, because Tierney was just ready to go, he was fully ready and was already basically a leader when he came through and captained them in cup games when he was dead young. And then you get more money for them when you sell them. You also get the benefit of having a top level fullback who then also gets the benefit of playing at a slightly, not easier level, because, I mean, the Premier League's is different to the Scottish Premiership, but it's a lot of players go from the Premiership to England and are amazing. Like Kenny McLean's decent. I'm trying to think of another one on the top of my head right now. The boy's just gone to Crystal Palace. Odson Edwards, right, is already just a decent player, right? Because you can just tell. Virgil van Dijk, he was amazing there and he's amazing there. You can just tell. Whereas weirdly, Shane Duffy is good in the Premier League, but he was absolutely garbage. One of the worst defenders I've ever seen play in the Premiership, comfortably for Celtic. That's a weird thing. But Patterson, staying on him, I can't remember what the fee was. I've seen different numbers going about, but it looks like he'd come in and maybe be like their next Seamus Coleman, that sort of player, who then can just learn his trade, break into the first team when he's ready, and then gives them width, pace, bit of skill. And if you're young enough to break into the Rangers first team and play for Scotland, he's properly can play for Scotland as a starter at that age. I think he's 19 maybe. You've probably got a good head on you, and that's a good sign. A lot of scouts look for, when they're looking for players, they look for players with a number of starts or a number of appearances, minutes, for example, at a certain age. And you can just assume they're probably pretty good or they've got the right mentality for it, because a lot of what makes a professional footballer or an elite footballer is their mentality. So when you talk to people when they're looking for trying to work out who the next big players are. They just look for it, literally just a Football Manager database, but on Y-Scout, wherever you go for minutes played or games and then their age. And then you can go and scout those to see, well, how come he's got that? How come he's got that? And that's where you start your little search for. I think he's such a good player. It'd be a really cool move for him. But he might have been better, get a couple of years at Rangers where he can then play every week and go up against Ross County rather than Liverpool, you know?
Mm, yeah. There we go. JJ Bull, the Bullet there. Thank you, JJ. Thank you to Seb Stafford, Bloor, Dankeschön.
Dankeschön, Herr Devine.
Yes. Thanks to all the listeners joining us again for another year, 2022. It's another one. And we hope you've all had a lovely festive holiday season. Until next week, when we shall return with Seb Stafford, Bloor and Alex Stewart, we bid you adieu. Goodbye, Seb. Goodbye, JJ. Goodbye, listeners. And thanks, as usual, to producers Adonis and Don.
The Athletic.